Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History, a channel from the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. Today I'll be speaking with Alexander Zevin about his new book, Liberalism at Large, The World According to The Economist. The Economist is a curious publication. It always takes a point of view, as opposed to the all-the-news-that's-fit-to-print approach. It maintains a uniform voice, as editors and writers are typically hand-picked from the same elite British universities, and rarely are there author bylines. And it has lasted a long time, originating back in London's free trade debates of the 1840s. It then actively participated in debates over imperialism, global war, decolonization, and globalization. To this day, it is one of the most widely read magazines around the world. For all of these reasons, The Economist also provides the perfect window onto the history of liberalism. This is exactly what Alexander Zevin does in his book. By examining The Economist, Zevin helps us see what he calls really existing liberalism, that is, a liberalism that rooted for empire, embraced finance, and has always held an ambivalence towards democracy. This is a book that we will be talking about for a long time. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm speaking with Alexander Zevin about his new book, Liberalism at Large, The World According to The Economist. Thanks for being on the show, Alexander.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, your book was a ton of fun to read, and I'm really glad that we're getting a chance to talk today. But just to begin our conversation, what pulled you down the route of becoming a historian?
That's a tough question to start with. I've always been interested in the past. I think when I was younger, the primary way that I enjoyed reading about the past was through novels, actually. When I was at Brown as an undergraduate, I really loved my literature classes. But I actually ended up, for strange reasons, becoming a history major through that study of literature. And I remember reading Benjamin's Arcades Project and being, especially as a young person, fascinated by the way that he had collected these fragments of experience of reading, of being in the archives, of walking through the arcades and of trying to extrapolate something about Paris as the capital of the 19th century, the capital of modernity through that. I also took courses with a professor named Mary Gluck, who did a series of classes on modernity, and used all kinds of not just literature but also art and aesthetics to talk about the past. And I was particularly fascinated by the Situationist. I was basically very romantic, revolutionary, and it kind of gradually moved from literature to history, and then became a major and graduated with a history degree at Brown.
Mm-hmm. So the route was paved by Benjamin, Guy Debord, the rest of the Situationists.
Yeah, and from there into Western Marxism. I also took, again, in a slightly unconventional maybe way into that, because I also took courses in modern culture and media with a guy named Philip Rosen, who was a great teacher. And we read some of the classic works of Western Marxism. And so I sort of moved from a kind of emphasis on culture to political economy. And in a way, I think that was good preparation for the book that I ended up writing many, many years later, because The Economist is a weekly publication that touches on almost every facet of experience. Not always from a particularly artistic point of view, rather a utilitarian one, but I think that it allowed me to uncover and to think about economics in a way that maybe wouldn't have been the case if I hadn't had that slightly more eclectic set of interests when I was younger.
And so as soon as I heard about your book, I just kind of said to myself, like, why hasn't anyone written this before? The Economist just seems like just such an obvious candidate for a history of liberalism. And you've already kind of mentioned some of your reasons for getting into it, but like, what struck you about The Economist that just made you want to write a book about it?
Well, I began writing the book as an article. It was just a short article for Le Monde Diplomatique, and I was living in Paris at the time, and I was going to actually be working on a project on 1968 and the history of ideas to do with student and workers in that period. And so this took me away from that, but I ended up becoming more and more fascinated by it, in part because I realized that far from being the history of a publication or a traditional publishing history, I didn't want to write a sort of standard history of a magazine, which I think can often be about as interesting as a dutiful Hollywood biopic, the rise, the fall, and the rise, or internal office politics. Not that that's uninteresting, but I realized that the editors, many of them are not very well known, but published prolifically, who had large archives that I could access and read. These people were often, though not well known, deeply involved in formulating policy at the level of the state. So in Britain, at the Treasury, the first editor becomes a minister of state, very powerful one, a secretary of the Treasury. He's writing minutes and notes on what the British government should do in Ireland, very, very little, as it turns out. Ends up being sent to India as the very first Indian Chancellor of the Exchequer. He's also a political economist who writes theoretical treatises. Hayek, I found some reviews where Hayek, who was a student of the history of political economy, to a much greater extent actually than maybe Keynes, was really fascinated by James Wilson, I think there's actually a lot to say about that. I don't really in the book, but it would make a good article. Anyway, I realized that there was a huge story to tell about not just this magazine, as interesting as that is, but also about the way that this magazine has played an important role via its editors and also its readers in shaping the modern world through this dominant ideology of liberalism. And I'm careful to make clear in the book that I don't consider The Economist to be the purest or the only expression of liberalism, but the dominant form. And that's kind of my attempt to intervene in an historiographical debate and in a debate that has sort of, really been a central one for political theorists about what liberalism is and our ability to define it. So I think that's a long-winded way of beginning to answer your question as to why it is that this project grew and grew and grew and seemed much more fascinating the more I looked into it.
Mm-hmm. I think that what your book really reveals is that The Economist is both sort of a witness to world history, from the 1840s into the present, but then repeatedly, they exercise an incredible amount of influence for a magazine. So, before we get into the angle of the book, which is about liberalism, I would love to know more about the research that went into it. So, you know, reading your book, it's very clear that you spent a lot of time just reading back issues. But from the footnotes, it's also clear that you visited several archives. And so I'm just curious what sort of the archival experience was like, and was there a particular archive or like set of documents that really transformed your thinking?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. There were some great discoveries that I made in the archives that pushed the research forward. One constraint that I initially faced was that the Economist's archives were largely destroyed in the Blitz during the Second World War, along with much of their offices in London. So there wasn't a lot of material. What material was left was difficult to access. I wasn't able to get anyone at The Economist to allow me to see those documents. The author that The Economist hired to publish a book about their history in 1993 for the sesquicentennial, a woman named Ruth Dudley Edwards, had sort of collected what there was, and sort of I had the impression it was in a bunch of boxes that were molding somewhere in the Economist office towers in St. James in London. At any rate, towards the end of my research, the collection, what there is of it is being archived at Oxford now. And anyway, that wasn't the case when I began my research, so I had to be more inventive in finding my material. And the way that I went about it was through individual editors. So after the turn of the 20th century, or around that time, Economist editors are quite consistently, though not exclusively, drawn from the universe of Oxbridge. And many of them left papers with the libraries of their colleges. So Francis Hurst, the editor from 1907 to 1916, has a large collection of papers at the Bodleian. He went to Wadham, and those papers were, you know, have been looked at by a few scholars, but not many. So I found a lot of fascinating material there. He was someone, as the editor of The Economist, who was in touch with, you know, almost every important member of the Liberal government, the government that came to, you know, that won a landslide election in Britain in 1906. So, you know, letters to Herbert Henry Asquith, or to the Attorney General John Simon, or, you know, I found some very interesting exchanges between him and J.A. Hobson, the theorist of imperialism, and also a new liberal who would later desert the Liberal Party for the Labour Party. So, you know, there were things like that. On the other hand, I would also find letters that James Wilson sent to William Gladstone. One thing that was very interesting that the original history of The Economist underplayed was that James Wilson is one of the founding investors, the kind of creators of Standard Chartered Bank, which is today one of the largest banks in Asia. And in the early 1850s, he was lobbying very hard against the wishes of the East India Company to get a charter so that he, in part, could profit off the opium that was flowing between India and China, and also, off of the general increase in trade in the region. And, you know, so I tracked down that the sort of original, you know, investor list at the London Municipal Archives. So, it was a matter of going to a lot of different disparate archives. Some were the personal archives that belonged to the editors at Oxford. Some were company archives. So because Wilson was an investor in Standard Chartered, that collection was at the London Municipal Archives. In other cases, I had to go as far afield as Stanford to the Hoover Institute. And I don't know if you've ever had any reason to go there. It's a kind of fascinating, even a little bit of a creepy place. This kind of right-wing institution that houses a lot of left-wing material. At any rate, some of the editors, again, not very well known in the 50s and 60s, 1950s and 60s now, of course, the book, you know, spans over two centuries of history. these editors, a particular two fellows named Brian Crozier Robert Moss, who had a lot of shadowy connections to intelligence, Western intelligence agencies, and who were massive opponents of the of détente during the Cold War. Going to those archives at the Hoover Institute was also fascinating, because there too, although sort of not well known and maybe not major players, were exchanging letters with Nixon, disgruntled about the, you know, the overreach of investigative journalists like Seymour Hersh, or of the Church Commission, who, you know, had overstepped the bounds of what, you know, what democratic accountability should look like when it came for the intelligence community. So just, you know, kind of the more I looked, the more I pushed, the more I found these really fascinating documents. And that added to the base of the research, which, as you say, was just reading far, far, far too many economist leaders. And I'd like to think I hold the world record for you know, number of economist articles read.
we should get this verified.
Yeah, no, I don't want to. I'm just putting it out there. If there's someone who wants to look into the matter, it's a dubious distinction.
Yeah, I mean, if someone has you beat, that person has just got to be a freak.
Yeah. Like let them come forward, you know, through the transmission of this book, this podcast, and contact me. DMs are open.
Exactly. just getting into the book now, as you've already mentioned, The Economist, you know, according to you, is the dominant stream of liberalism. So it's not like the only or purist, but it's the dominant. This stream of liberalism is very different from other sort of tellings of the history of liberalism, especially those that are written by liberals. Can you just like briefly walk our listeners through liberalism's autobiography?
Right. So I think the standard definition, and it's one that I have a lot of problems with, is a loose body of thought cohering around concepts of individual freedom or liberty, and usually those accounts of liberalism begin either in the 18th century either in the 17th century with John Locke at Life, Liberty, and Property, conceiving of John Locke as the first liberal, or with Adam Smith in the 18th century, political economist and moral philosopher, and his liberal system of political economy based around ideas of free trade. I think that both of those definitions are inadequate and lead to a quite misleading picture of what liberalism has actually meant, both in theory and in practice. So one of the ideas behind this book was to use The Economist to give a much more grounded and contextualist definition of liberalism that acknowledges the ways that it changes over time, but that also points to the consistencies between early 19th century notions of liberalism and liberalism in our own day. So it both pushes it back against a kind of a conceptual looseness as well as an anachronistic set of definitions of liberalism, but it also pushes back against those who would say, well, liberalism can't really be defined. That's a fool's errand. It means too many things to really try and take hold of. So I do that in part in the introduction by carefully laying out the moment of the emergence of liberals and of liberalism in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars, first in Spain at the Cortes of Cadiz, migrating to France in the aftermath of the Bourbon Restoration. In both cases, the definition is primarily political. Liberals define themselves as opponents of, on the one hand, the ancien regime and autocratic government, and on the other hand, against the kind of mass popular mobilizations, in the case of France, of the sans-culottes and of the Jacobins. And they usually stand for something like responsible government, basic civil liberties, and some limited form of franchise. The term then migrates to Britain, where I argue there is a unique synthesis that takes place between those continental political ideas of what liberals stand for and the economic liberalism to do with maxims of free trade, internal and external, property rights, low taxes, in versions of limited government. So one of the reasons I argue that The Economist is so valuable to us in trying to come up with a better definition is that it emerges at just this moment when the synthesis between political and economic liberalism is taking place uniquely in Britain. And I can go into greater detail about that, but that moment is the 1840s.
Mm-hmm. The Economist really does mark this synthesis, and you paint such a compelling picture of why The Economist, is like a more appropriate subject of, or object of analysis if you're interested in the history of liberalism. Before we get into that particular moment, I would love to hear you talk a little bit about the three unanswered questions that liberals have, because this is these questions are sort of the grand themes with which you organize your book, and so that's how liberals should respond to the rise of democracy, how they should respond to the expansion of empire, and how they should respond to the ascendancy of finance. Can you just elaborate on these questions, why they remain unanswered, and what The Economist has to say about them?
Yeah, great. So in your last question, my answer to that question was about what I don't like about most accounts that we have of liberalism. So if my history is not about sort of the centrality of individual liberty or freedom in the history of liberal thought and of practice, then what is it about? I argue that liberals from the 1840s forward confront three questions that the classical doctrine, as it emerged in the previous few decades, left unanswered. Right? And so The Economist, in a sense, acts as a kind of practical guide confronting these challenges as they arise in a kind of world historical sense. The first is the rise of demands for mass democracy on the part of the working class, in Britain felt acutely. The thing about the early liberals is that they wanted responsible government, but the question was responsible to who, right? Liberals are not Democrats, mm-hmm. right, by and large. And so the issue of who gets to vote, right, on what terms, is something that liberals will grapple with all the way up to the present. And in a sense, I think the foregrounding of democracy, the issue of democracy, the fact that liberalism and democracy are not synonymous but actually contradictory in the eyes of many liberals, that is aligned through to the present and helps us understand why it is that we live in a moment where liberalism and democracy, the very notion of liberal democracy, or the idea that we live in liberal democracies and that this is a kind of stable value or set of values that go together, it shows why that might not be the case, and it helps us understand that. So that's the first point. What do they have to say about the demands of the working class, at first organized in the Chartists, but then extending much further? What do they have to say about that? The second point is about the spread of empires. So what do liberals have to say about this, in particular in Britain, but not exclusively? Can the liberal state also be an imperial state? Are liberals opposed to empire as a form of aristocratic, monopolistic, mercantilist vestiges of the past? Or can empires themselves be liberal? Are empires, in fact, central to the spread of free trade rather than the opposite of free trade, as Adam Smith argued, right? Again, doesn't figure in the classical doctrine, but is absolutely central to the practice of liberal politics and liberal thought during the subsequent two centuries. The third point is the rise of high finance. here in particular, The Economist allows us to understand the political ramifications and worldview of a magazine based in the city of London, which is about to send more capital abroad than any other country ever has in the history of the world. And the kinds of politics that go along with that. So from my perspective, the Economist allows us to understand the kind of politics, the corollary of that kind of emphasis on foreign investment on the part of the city of London, and to understand, you know, what does this a massive transformation in the conditions of economic life around the world? What do liberals have to say about that? And again, this doesn't really figure in the core doctrine insofar as people like Smith or Ricardo and others who are thinking about the relationship between agriculture and industry and of labor. You know, what about speculation, right? What about things that are not productive of value in the classical conception of liberalism? Are these legitimate forms of economic activity as well? And anyway, The Economist, sorry to ramble, but The Economist allows us to try and answer that question too. So democracy, finance, empire, those are the kind of the grand themes that hold up the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll be dipping back into each of those themes as we go on. But get us started with the history of The Economist. Can you share with listeners, who founded The Economist and what his motivations were?
So The Economist was founded by a guy named James Wilson, and he was a hat manufacturer. He was the son of a textile manufacturer, so he's quite well to do. Actually, he was came from a good family, from Howick in Scotland, and he sets up a business outside of London. But he very quickly gets involved in the Anti-Corn Law League, and he begins to write treatises of political economy. And one of the reasons that he becomes such an important kind of member of that Corn Law League is that he furnishes it with a very effective argument. You know, as your listeners may or may not know, the Anti-Corn Law League arises as a really important kind of middle class social movement designed to eliminate tariffs on grain, which are seen as inhibiting British economic growth and to be unfairly benefiting the landowning aristocratic class at the expense of the middle classes and the rising industrial class, right? So his argument is that, you know, far from wishing to attack or diminish the importance of the landowning class, the abolition of the corn laws will see all classes benefit. So this is a kind of natural harmony theory of economics in which wages will rise, industrial output will rise, and so will the rent from land. Richard Cobden and John Bright, two of the most famous orators and thinkers, themselves manufacturers, to be part of the Anti-Corn Law League, take Wilson up because they see this as an incredibly effective piece of rhetoric. And it's not always clear to me that Bright and Cobden really accept it. They have a much more conflictual account of economics. That accepts that different classes have different interests and that the landlord class will have to be basically defeated. But they see it as a very effective tool. And it's important, I think, to understanding the way that The Economist conceives of political economy. This initial argument that Wilson makes carries over into the magazine. At any rate, he's a manufacturer. He becomes a political economist. He founds this magazine. He wants the Anti-Corn Law League to help him to distribute it. But he also is very eager to reach what he calls the landed and moneyed interests, and indeed finds a lot of support among the kind of Whig grandees who sit in Parliament. And it's this fusion of middle class rabble rousers like Cobden and Bright, and his support among these Whig aristocrats that allows him to launch The Economist and to try to speak to both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Just so initially, James Wilson held the belief or subscribed to the belief that peace and free trade went together. But then within just a couple decades, he and other editors decide to abandon this in favor of imperial violence with the aim of expanding trade. And I just want to share a really startling quote from The Economist in 1857, in the middle of the Second Opium War, in which Britain was coercing China into importing opium. The editor wrote, "We may regret war, but we cannot deny that great advantages have followed in its wake." So why did The Economist latch onto war? And what should that tell us about liberalism?
So one of the discoveries that I made in the book that I was most excited about was the falling out between Wilson and Cobden and Bright, right? These two guys, Cobden and Bright, gave The Economist its start. You know, they take a bet on Wilson and on this newspaper that he founds. But by 1854, they have a terrible row, a terrible falling out, because Wilson at that point is a high-ranking member of the government. They are in Parliament, Cobden and Bright, but they are deeply critical of the direction of this government. Wilson comes out in favor of the Crimean War. And this is a moment of a kind of burst of imperial warfare. There's the Crimean War. There's the suppression of the Indian Mutiny or Rebellion. There's the Second Opium War. All are being fought in quick succession. And The Economist backs all three. For Cobden and Bright, this is a betrayal of the basic principles of liberalism, right? In which free trade equals peace and goodwill. That's the idea that this is not just a national project, right? Liberalism, if it spreads, if free trade spreads, will lead to peace and goodwill among men. So why does The Economist take the side of the government in the Crimean War and then again in the Opium War? Well, in just a very simple way, Wilson becomes a member of the establishment and a member of the government, and he's ready to use The Economist to back the government's line. Very, very clearly. But I think there's a deeper reason, which is that the notion that free trade equals peace and goodwill is flawed, that there really isn't the connection there that the early liberals think there is. For Wilson, it becomes quite clear that force majeure is going to be necessary to force people to trade freely, right? So it's perfectly legitimate to use the pretext of the Arrow incident, which is the pretext that the British use to bombard Canton in a joint Anglo-French expedition. And it's also perfectly legitimate to try and punish Russia for attempting to interfere with the Ottoman Empire, not because they have many illusions about the Ottomans, but because for one, it threatens British control over the Mediterranean and British interests in the Near East, but also because very early on, The Economist adopts the line that Britain is a threat to liberalism. It is an illiberal power, autocratic, anti-free trade, religiously fanatical, and you know, there you can see quite clearly that this discourse that is ever present in American politics today is there already in the 1850s. The notion that liberalism actually may have to be forced on people at the point of a gun, and then really from that moment on, the Economist never really looks back. It begins to call the notion of peace of free trade leading to peace and goodwill among men a shallow doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Something that your book does really well is just documents the economists' support for war. And I could not believe the number of wars that they, you know, boosted. And I will say, I used to be a very proud subscriber to The Economist until the issue where they called on the United States to invade Syria and overthrow Bashar al-Assad. And it was just like this, like very, like imperialistic, explicit endorsement of violence. And so that was actually the reason why I dropped my subscription. And so seeing sort of like the prehistory to this, you know, it was still surprising just the number of times that The Economist was calling for war even before the war, you know, had started.
So you reacted instinctively or based on your political judgment that this was a, you know, quite an outrageous thing to demand yet another invasion of a country in North Africa or Middle East to impose a settlement favorable to the Western powers or based on liberal principles. And actually that is, you know, there's an historical basis to that that is really rich and actually important, I think, for understanding what liberalism has actually meant. And it's not, I mean, you know, there's a way in which I just assemble the record of The Economist. It's an audit of The Economist's record. But I think by assembling, by making that audit, our conception of what liberalism is has to contend with that and to change. And, you know, it's quite common to this day to hear people invoke liberal internationalism as though it had nothing to do with this history of warfare and violence and of imperialism. But of course, it's absolutely central. So how does that change our understanding of liberalism? It has to change it profoundly. Part of my book is critical of The Economist, but it's about something bigger than that.
Yeah, there are all these elements of liberalism that liberalism has, told us they don't actually belong. They're on the outside of liberalism or they're peripheral. But I think what your book shows is that they've actually been quite central. So just moving on a little bit, so The Economist becomes a really important magazine for the expansion of capitalism in the 19th century. It was the first paper to collect and publish wholesale prices. And so it's providing this service, service to financiers. And it also began to cover the global cotton beat. And so you had traders really rely on The Economist to know, you know, what was going on in the U.S. Civil War or, the development of cotton markets in India or Egypt. And so can you say something about the political economic role of The Economist in the 19th century?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most important elements of the paper. But it's important not to treat it in isolation. I wanted to connect this this vision of the global economy that The Economist actually creates to what liberalism has meant. I think there's a tendency to treat, you know, political ideas in isolation from economic factors. But I think in The Economist, the two mingle, you know, in the same page or in adjacent columns, right? The Economist very early on is the most important guide for British investors, but also for global investors, because the paper very early on, even when it has a very small circulation of a few thousand in Britain, begins to be shipped to Buenos Aires or New York or Paris, right? The capitals of world commerce, and is used by investors to understand the risk and rewards of placing their capital abroad, right? In a world in which capital for the first time is footloose in an unprecedented way, where capital flows are moving at speed to open up new mining ventures in Australia or in Southern Africa or to irrigate and to push forward the agricultural belts in Argentina or in Russia, and we could go on to build the railways that are going to connect, the United States or or various countries in Latin America and elsewhere, The Economist plays an absolutely pivotal role in explaining to people what is happening on the ground in the places to which they are sending their money. So it's really the first paper to do that. And I think that's really fundamental to understand. You know, today we live in a world in which we accept that, you know, Moody's or Fitch's or Standard & Poor or these other credit rating agencies, you know, get to determine the, you know, the creditworthiness of nations. The Economist is really the first to evaluate different countries, colonies, municipalities even, as well as companies, to see the world through the prism of creditworthiness, right? And I think it was very interesting to read Marx, who long before I came along saw the importance of the Economist, not just to understanding kind of the ups and downs of the trade cycle, because he's reading The Economist in 1848 and after to try and understand why it is that the springtime of the peoples in Europe has kind of fizzled and that reaction has gained traction everywhere in Europe. And he sees the sort of, he sees the trade cycle and the upturn in trade as being very important to explaining that. He's reading The Economist in order to understand that. But he also sees in The Economist what he calls the point of view or the perspective of the aristocracy of European finance, in which kind of public debt, state credit is on the line. You know, and he quotes The Economist in the 18th Brumaire as sort of discussing the, you know, the political happenings with Louis Napoleon, later Napoleon III, is through the prism of the stock market. I could go on about that, but I think that there's a kind of practical element to that. The Economist is read by people who want to understand the risks and rewards of placing their money abroad, but there's also a kind of profound political dimension to it, a version of liberalism that evaluates states and politics from the point of view of financial stability and investments. And I think that is kind of an underappreciated shift in liberal politics in the 19th century that The Economist brings out absolutely clearly.
Mm-hmm. And so your book goes through a lot of history, and unfortunately we don't have too much time left for this conversation. So we're going to leap over a pretty vast swath of time. And I would like to hear from you what The Economist has to say about the end of empire. And so, you know, in the 19th century, it is, supporting these imperial interventions. It's supporting the British takeover of Egypt. And then, you know, you get to the age of decolonization in the 1940s and 50s. And so what does The Economist, how does The Economist see decolonization?
Right. So this was fascinating to study in the context of a wider literature about liberals and decolonization, right? Liberals, the kind of liberalism that The Economist represents is not reconciled to decolonization in the aftermath of the Second World War. And there's almost a consensus among the British political class that Britain will continue to exercise imperial dominion abroad. It may do so in coordination or partnership with the United States on the one hand and Soviet Russia on the other, but it's not going anywhere. And indeed, you know, the British cabinet takes the decision not just to build a British nuclear bomb as to make that point perfectly clear, but also to retain their military assets and bases in the Middle East. This is true all the way up till 1956 and the moment at which that begins to look untenable. So it's not the case that liberals simply accept decolonization. And even after Suez, the whole question of who and what will come to replace the colonial regimes, whether those colonial regimes are the French or the Portuguese or the British themselves, is absolutely pivotal. If we're talking about kind of radical communist or even nationalist movements that want to redistribute land, nationalize the natural resources, whether those are, you know, tin mines or copper mines or oil or gas, or oil, I should say, the question of whether or not war should be fought to prevent that outcome, or one side should be favored over another, is absolutely in play, right? On the other hand, if a country agrees to become a member of the Commonwealth, to agree to continue to accept British ownership of the assets that I just mentioned, then independence may be granted, right? Also depends on how close the government is to the Soviet Union or not. So what I wanted to show was that decolonization is not only slow, not only resisted, but also that it's dealt with on a case-by-case basis. So Britain fights a number of wars to retain colonial possessions that are long-lasting in Kenya, in Malaya. Britain is deeply involved in the Konfrontasi in Indonesia that ends in the ouster of Suharto and the murder of 500,000 suspected communists. I tried to use The Economist to talk about the ways that both British and American officials think about, understand those movements, and to justify those interventions that they end up making in liberal terms. And the book deals with a number of cases, not just Malaya, Kenya, and Indonesia, but also Cyprus, interventions in the Caribbean, Iran, which is a hugely important episode in 1954 that the British and the Americans intelligence services are both deeply involved in. Again, The Economist plays an important role there. So I'm just listing different episodes that the book talks about. But overall, I think the picture, I want to suggest that the picture of a kind of inevitable glide path towards decolonization, or the idea that this dominant version of liberalism is sort of comes to terms with decolonization very early on, completely wrong.
And so one of the transitions that you document in the book is how The Economist sort of reoriented itself towards the U.S. In the decades after the Second World War. And, the paper was kind of following a changing geography within liberalism itself, with like Washington kind of Washington and New York overtaking London as sort of like an imperial financial center. And so I was actually really surprised at how peripheral the U.S. was even until the 1950s. You show that The Economist finally got a Washington-based reporter in 1953. And then even then, the American section of The Economist was remarkably underfunded. But the editors were beginning to reorient the paper. And so I'm just curious, like, what was driving the editors in the post-war era to put more and more resources towards, covering the United States, but then also luring more American readers?
Yeah, so I think that there's a number of factors that explain the importance of the United States to The Economist. One is that The Economist has always been, as I try to show, deeply implicated in the British state. And that, in fact, to create this liberal world, The Economist had to be close to the levers of power inside the state apparatus, whether that was at the Treasury or in the House of Lords and Parliament, or in individual ministries or as representatives and diplomatic envoys abroad. So in the Cold War period in particular, The Economist and its staffers are attempting to negotiate the relationship, the special relationship, if you will. So one way of thinking about The Economist in the post-war period up to the present is as actually one of the clearest instantiations of the special relationship, which is actually a very fraught one. And there's a debate internal to The Economist as to how close the paper should be to American decision makers. Should The Economist and its journalists play a role similar to the one that they had played in the previous century, as kind of brokers between, on the one hand, the City of London and its readers, and the state and the Liberal Party? Should it do something similar in the U.S.? And eventually it does. By the 1980s, Andrew Knight, who really is the one by the late 70s, early 80s, Andrew Knight, who is the one who pushes for a kind of polished marketing attempt to kind of bring the Economist circulation up in the United States. So the kind of concerted effort to sort of raise the Economist circulation in the U.S. really dates to the mid to late 70s under Knight. He then does, as the editor of The Economist, and he's a particularly kind of sociable, clubbable fellow, becomes close to members of the Reagan administration, you know, has dinner at the White House, is very close friends with George Shultz, is on the phone with Henry Kissinger when, you know, it comes time to discuss SALT treaties, detente, China, you know, whatever it is. And Kissinger later will do a kind of chilling publicity campaign for The Economist, which I mentioned in the book and is just a humorous interlude. So
just really quickly, when I saw that, I instantly went to YouTube to watch it. it's really amazing.
Right. Basically, an airline passenger gets on the flight, sits down at his seat in first class, of course, is sipping champagne, has his suspenders on, and, you know, thinks he's, you know, about to have a nice little voyage. And all of a sudden, the person that sits down next to him is Henry Kissinger. And he slumps down in his seat because what in God's name will he talk to Henry Kissinger about if he hasn't read The Economist that week? That says a lot about how close The Economist ends up becoming to American officials, particularly those who craft foreign policy. The earlier period, though, that you asked me about, this moment of transition, comes in fits and starts, and it takes place. I think it's particularly evident around the time of Suez, where there's this sort of question and back and forth discussion about, can Britain any longer act alone in pursuing its imperial interests? And, you know, the retired editor Jeffrey Crowther is quite clear that the Americans must be brought on board. Since around that time, you know, most editors of The Economist pass some of their apprenticeship in the United States, whether that's with a Harkness Fellowship or a Commonwealth Fellowship, which again is part of that infrastructure created after the Second World War to burnish the special relationship between Britain and the United States, or as reporters on Wall Street or in California. It's absolutely essential, I think, that any editor show that they understand the United States and have spent some time in the United States. And I guess what I'm saying in a long-winded way is that is because the mantle of liberal empire, which is what The Economist has stood for, passes to the United States, and it becomes clear that it's the United States that's going to uphold this version of globalization, free trade, safety of capital and foreign investment abroad, especially in the climate of the Cold War, where there's this communist enemy that threatens all of those things. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just reaching into the end of your book, I was really interested in how you're tracking sort of what liberalism, you know, actually is. You know, you call it actually existing liberalism. But you also, I think, track the changes that liberalism has undergone in the past century and a half. I was just kind of curious, if The Economist founder James Wilson and one of the more recent editors, or Andrew Knight, for instance, were to meet, do you think they would recognize each other as liberals?
That's a great way of putting that question. I think that Wilson would be quite put out, in part because his version of laissez-faire liberalism was so uncompromising, and after his demise in India, and the steering of the paper by Walter Badgett, his son-in-law and successor, The Economist changes a great deal and accepts that the state is going to have to intervene in the market in order to simply to avoid financial crises, which become larger and larger as the global economy becomes more integrated. So I think that he would be a bit put out, but I think he'd be a bit put out by almost any editor that he met after the 1860s, including by Badgett. So would they recognize each other as liberals? I think that they would have understood each other in some respects as liberals. And I think that's the benefit of the democracy finance empire frame. Wilson would have understood Knight's interest in foreign investment and in the City of London. That would have been completely recognizable to him. He would have understood Knight's defense of liberal empire, and Knight does defend liberal empire, even against members of his staff who have, at the beginning at least, some really grave doubts about the wisdom of Thatcherism and of Reaganism and of some of the policies as regards Reagan in Israel, Thatcher when it came to taking on the trade unions, and whether or not that would really kind of lead to a kind of even more aggravated form of socialism rather than the hegemonic version of liberalism, of neoliberalism that it became. So I think when it comes to liberal empire, he would recognize Knight. And then when it came to democracy, I think he would be startled to see that the kind of working class had been enfranchised, but heartened to see the way that even after the advent of the suffrage on a popular basis, that the Economist had found ways to try and deal with the problem of trying to create stable markets, trying to create a legal and other ways of protecting property rights, even with something like mass democracy, whether that came through the establishment of independent central banks, whether it came through the depoliticization of the economic, the kind of making of guardrails, whether it came, whether it was, via a number of other ways. So if you see what I mean, I think on those levels, he would recognize something in the liberal project that was common. But then again, Wilson is, what makes Wilson fascinating is that he is this kind of the early crusading, uncompromising, completely pure and ideological version of liberalism that then kind of has to kind of change and adapt to all of these important world historical developments afterwards.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote a book about an organization, or rather a company that still exists. And so that means that your work is being read by The Economist now. And so what has been the response from The Economist?
So I know that there are a number of journalists at The Economist who've looked at my book. I think some of them have read it. The Economist published a review of the book that was a bit snide by a guy named Gottlieb at All Souls. Mm-hmm. I was surprised at the level to which it did not engage with the arguments of my book. It pointed to the portrayal of The Economist during the Irish famine or of The Economist's positions on war, but in a rather defensive manner, without sort of disputing that those positions had been taken, but merely pointing out that, if you were to read my book, you would be hard pressed to understand why The Economist has been such a success. Mm-hmm. Or you maybe be under the illusion that capitalism had, not been the wonderful success story that it has been, lifting billions out of poverty and, that kind of narrative. So I found the official response, the published kind of review of the book, a bit stale, if you will. But of course, I obviously respect The Economist, and I think it's extremely important. And I try to give The Economist credit where I think credit is due. And in part, that is about the way that The Economist uniquely does manage to cover the entire world, and does, it is deeply ideological, it's in the service of ideological ends, but does manage to give important data, information, news reports, analysis about what is happening everywhere. So, or tries to. So I think you know, I hope that there is more engagement and not just kind of defensiveness. Because on my end, you know, I wrote a spirited critique and challenge of the worldview of The Economist, which seems to me to be the dominant one. And of course, if it is the dominant one, as I claim it is, then it's responsible for a great deal of the chaos and instability and uncertainty through which we are living, right? And you know, it would be nice to have a lively debate. So far, that hasn't quite happened. If you see what I mean, but maybe it will, or maybe it won't, because you know. The journalists of The Economist don't see the mm-hmm. need to. I don't know.
Going off of that a bit, so you know, you get to the end of the book, you get to the present, and you know, we have a financial crisis, we have the rise of you know, these like new nationalist movements, you know, nationalism as an organizing principle in international relations. You see you know, like growing inequality, these populist movements that are responding to that inequality. And so it's like a discombobulating moment, especially for liberals. And so, you know, you kind of return to the three unanswered questions that you began the book with. And you say that because liberals haven't really engaged with these questions within the framework of liberalism, they don't actually, they can't explain like our current predicament, and they also can't see how liberalism has contributed to that predicament. Can you say something about this?
Yeah, I think that the response of The Economist and of other this is true of kind of mainstream liberalism in the United States as well. The way that self-identified liberals have reacted to the rise of Trump, the advent of Brexit. There's and now we're seeing it, I think, again with the rise of Sanders in the U.S. Democratic primaries. There's been a good deal of kind of hand-wringing of concern, but not a great deal of self-reflection, not a great deal of curiosity. Right, I think the populist label is one way that gets telegraphed. Right, everything is populist that is sort of critical of the status quo. It's a kind of insult. It's a pejorative term. It's death. You know, it's. I think it's that is a word that I find, you know, that has been very very loosely used. You know, I said the same about liberalism, but populism is kind of hurled about, I think, to as a way of almost not answering the question. So you know. I try to point out that the issues of finance insofar as debt is a huge factor in the rise of some of these movements, whether it's student debt or housing debt, in terms of democracy, in the sense that, you know, in most of these cases we're encountering there's a democratic victory that has not gone the way that elites or the establishment or so forth would like it to, right? The outcome of the Brexit vote, people were warned, right, by no less an authority than Obama or the head of JP Morgan Chase or NATO or the WTO, right, that they shouldn't do this, that this would leave them poorer. It would leave, you know, it would unsettle the fabric of Europe. You know, it would lead to a renewal of a autarkic conflict not seen since the 1930s and thus to another world war. And, you know, this is basically quite hysterical, the reactions, denunciations. And so, in a way, if liberals or the version of liberalism known as neoliberalism, that's something we haven't talked about that I think would be interesting to talk about more, the relationship between the two, I mean, given the dominance of this particular ideology, one would have to look to it and to its history to try and explain how it is that, you know, over three decades after the fall of the Berlin Wall, liberals who continue to control most of these international institutions continue to set policy, as well as to enjoy a kind of dominant position within the mainstream press, how it is we can explain the rise of these problems. And I think that too often liberals turn to some form of external or non-imminent critique, and in fact the answers are kind of there if one is ready to look. And so I do end the book on that note by suggesting that, you know, far from seeing Trump as a bolt from the blue, it would be far more interesting and probably factually accurate to understand him as the outcome of, you know, the course of American politics dominated by a version of liberalism, for the last 30 or 40 years, if not longer.
Mm-hmm. Great. And I think that's a wonderful place to leave the discussion about the book. But can you give a sense to our listeners what you're working on now?
I'm working on a few projects, ones that I hope to complete in a shorter amount of time than it took me to do this book. So I'm working on a few small pieces to do with the history of liberalism in the United States. And the reason that that term is particularly confused in the context of American history. I'm also looking to extend some of the work that I did in the book on financialization and its relationship to liberalism and to neoliberalism. I feel that the a lot of great work has been done about neoliberalism that's much more deeply historical than has been the case in the past. And I reviewed Quinn Slobodian's excellent book in the London Review of Books. And he has a great way of thinking about neoliberalism historically. A new book by Jessica White called The Morals of the Market does something similar in as regards human rights and the relationship between those two things. I think I'd like to think a bit more deeply about what in fact is unique about the neo and neoliberalism and what neoliberals draw from explicitly or implicitly in this earlier tradition that I have examined. And then finally, I'm interested in a much larger project that I'm still working to kind of conceptualize, which is a history, an intellectual history of planning and ideas of planning from Saint-Simon and the Fourierists and the Owenites all the way up to today. So, you know, I felt that I should do something even bigger and more unwieldy than working on The Economist. Those are some thoughts I had.
Great. All of those sound really, really interesting, and I look forward to reading them. So, Alexander, thank you again for being on the show.
Thanks so much.
It's been a real pleasure talking about your book. That book is Liberalism at Large, The World According to The Economist. And you've been listening to New Books in History, a channel with the New Books Network.